From the latest on Caribbean cruises to kosher safaris, pilgrimages to Jewish Eastern Europe and award-winning wines and international cuisine in sun-drenched Tel Aviv. Sit back and enjoy the trip with the travel edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast. And a very warm welcome to the second edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast travel edition. Mark, over the course of the last few days, we've had quite a few emails asking why we decided to launch a travel podcast during this whole COVID experience.
I think we decided to do this because that light at the end of the tunnel is coming. It's certainly in Israel, people have had their second vaccines. In America, over 30 million people have been vaccinated, and travel is coming back on the agenda with a vengeance.
Which is great news for people like us and yourselves as well. And we'd love to read your comments that you can leave with your podcast provider about travel, where it is that you miss, where you're looking forward to going. And now we're going to tell you where we're going over the next 20 minutes or so.
In this episode, we're going to fly to Istanbul. And much closer to home, we head north in Israel to the reserve of Tel Dan.
Before we do that, though, as is our custom, we're going to ask you a couple of quiz questions that are related to our venues for today.
Question number one. What is the longest word in Turkish? And you can give yourself a bonus point if you know its meaning in English.
And the second question. Which mountain lies just to the west of Tel Dan? We'll bring you the answers at the end of the podcast. Biblical Noah was arguably the first cruise ship passenger to dock in Turkey when he sailed onto Mount Ararat in his ark. These days, Turkey attracts some 50 million tourists each year, while many head for the beaches of Antalya and some for the stunning rock formations of Cappadocia. It's Istanbul that's the jewel in Turkey's crown for most visitors. And now it's time to meet local tour guide Kenan Tamer.
I'm an 8th generation Istanbulian, and I've been a tour guide for the past 31 years. I started in 89. I've been around the world. I've been to over 100 countries. I went to the American school in Istanbul. And then I went on a full scholarship to the US and did business and economics. And then a full scholarship for in master's for hotel and restaurant management. And this is what I do. I love traveling, and I hope it shows in my commentary.
I was in Istanbul about 2 years ago, and it was full of amazing buildings. What should be top of people's lists when they come to Istanbul?
Well, there's so much, but what I like to do, especially for the North Americans, is because their benchmark is 1492, I like to start off chronologically. Istanbul, within the old city, has seven hills, but most of everything is on the first hill. So what I do, if people have a couple of days, is I'll start off with the Archaeology Museum, which has an amazing collection that shows the whole history of the Eastern Mediterranean. And then I'll move on to the Hagia Irini, which is right next door in the grounds of the Topkapı Palace, a church from the 6th century, built by Justinian. It's a smaller church, but then I go on to the Hagia Sophia, which is, of course, the grand church built by Justinian. Now it's been converted back into a mosque after having been a museum for a long time. Next door is the underground basilica cistern. This is an amazing water storage area with 336 columns underground and partially filled with water. And then I move on to the hippodrome where the old gladiator fights took place. And then there's a new one now called the Şerefiye Cistern or the Theodosius Cistern, prettier than the underground basilica cistern and doesn't have the lines. And then I'll go on to Constantine's Column where Helena had the true parts of the true cross, the nails that went into Jesus's body buried underneath this column. And then my last stop would be in the earlier things, pre-Turkish things, would be St. Saviour in Kora, this amazing church that depicts the life of Mary and Jesus in mosaics. The next day, I'll go on to the Turkish stuff and I'll start up with the Topkapı Palace, visiting the harem. The treasury is closed, but some of the bits are being shown in different parts of the palace. I'll go on to the Blue Mosque, which is under renovation at this time, but once this pandemic is over, I think it'll be open. And after the Blue Mosque, I'll go on to, right next door is the Turkish and Islamic Arts Museum. and then perhaps follow on to the Grand Bazaar and the Spice Bazaar, or skip, leave the shopping till the very end and go on to Suleiman the Magnificent's Mosque. But definitely combine that. I mean, Istanbul is not your grandmother that you visit and you see her old antiques. It's a thriving, living city, and I hope that's been, that will be the experience for you. It has an amazing art scene. It has these artsy-fartsy neighborhoods where you can visit art galleries, have people watch, have coffee, San Sebastian cake. A definite worthwhile thing to do is to go on a cruise on the Bosphorus during the day, just before sunset. But definitely at night, you can do it at night as well. But you don't see the rich people's homes if you do it late at night. So you want to make sure that you have some light to see these amazing. The most expensive home for sale is $115 million. So that gives you an idea of how much money there is in Istanbul. If you have a long time that you want to take it easy in Istanbul, I'll also go to the Prince Islands. These are without cars. And we used to have horse carriages, but now because of cruelty to animals, we've switched to electric little buses, which are just as scenic. But basically the Prince Islands have these quaint, beautiful wooden mansions that go back to the Ottoman time. So it's like going back in a time warp and seeing what old Istanbul was like. Of course, I'll definitely see Dolmabahçe Palace, which is the last palace that the Ottoman sultans used. Perhaps I'll go on to the Istanbul Modern, Arter, and the Pera Museum, if you're into the art scenes. These, they have very good collections. So those would be my top 30. Did I just say 30? Yeah.
It's going to be a busy couple of days. You mentioned the markets and the bazaars. Where should I go if I want a bargain?
The Grand Bazaar, the Spice Bazaar, and the Arasta Bazaar. Arasta Bazaar is right next door to the Blue Mosque. Those three is what I would call the older style ones. But if you're into modern shopping, Istanbul is now full of malls like the European Sense and American Sense. And they have local brands plus foreign brands. So if you want to check out the Turkish textile scene, that's also a good place. Many, many good malls to go to.
Istanbul has a rich Jewish history as well as the other histories that you've outlined. How can visitors get to see that?
Even before the arrival of the Turks, there was a Jewish past in Turkey, modern Turkey today. There's an area called Balat, B-A-L-A-T, and this is right next to the Golden Horn. And there's working synagogues and beautiful old Jewish homes. And Turkey was the first Muslim country to recognize Israel in 1948. And in the first 10 countries to do so, Ben-Gurion got his law degree from Istanbul University. So he actually spoke Turkish and he has his law degree from us. And Einstein petitioned the Turkish government in the 1930s, seeing what was happening in Germany at the time, and asking for these Jewish professors to be brought into Turkey. And they are responsible for setting up some of the best departments at the universities of Ankara and Istanbul. But Balat is the place to go. And there's 19 working synagogues, and they're spread out throughout the city, some of the newer ones as well. I love Kuzguncuk, K-U-Z-G-U-N-C-U-K, where we have a church, a mosque, and a synagogue, literally side by side, wall to wall. It's a very quaint neighborhood. Karaköy is very happening. It has also two synagogues. But Balat is the place to go. There's the working Jewish hospital, many working synagogues. But in 1948, when Israel was founded, Israel placed ads in Turkish papers beckoning the Turkish Jews. And the ads read, come with your mesh cupboards. And I asked my grandma, I was like, what the hell does this mesh cupboards mean? And then she said, Canon, in those days, people didn't have refrigerators. And you had a mesh cupboard, it kept the bugs out. And Israel is hotter than Turkey. And they asked the Jews to bring the mesh cupboards with them to keep the bugs out.
Excellent story. So while we're on the Jewishy side of things, a lot of our listeners obviously keep kosher or want to eat vegetarian, sort of worst case scenario. Are there options within the tourist areas of Istanbul? And as Mark suggested to me, do any of them have any rooftop views of the Bosphorus?
Turks are suckers for views. I mean, there are so many. We would rather, no fire regulations, forget it. We might just as well burn, but we'll go out with a bang and watch the view. There's a lot of restaurants. As far as kosher is concerned, there used to be two, but I've checked on their websites. They're closed for the time being. Vegetarian is the easiest because Turkish cuisine is Mediterranean cuisine, and the what we call the starters or the meze are nothing but olive oil cooked vegetarian dishes. There are grocery stores and butchers, like six of them in the city, that provide kosher products. But as far as kosher food is concerned, the two we've had during this pandemic have shut down. So, but by the time tourism picks up again, perhaps they'll come back again.
How do our listeners get in contact with you if they'd like to tour Istanbul?
I have an email, of course, my name and last name at yahoo.com. So KENANTAMER at yahoo.com. On Instagram, I am Kenan_Tamer. Facebook, KJ Tamer, KJTAMER. So those are the three ways to get in touch with me.
Kenan Tamer, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Turkey is an iceberg. There is so much more to see. Please, if you come in May, try and include Sagalassos and the rose harvest. Make sure you try and go out to Cappadocia, see this amazing landscape. Come to Izmir, which also has a huge Jewish past, and try and visit Ephesus. Go over to the east, which is 2,000 meters above sea level, see Kars, and visit a UNESCO World Heritage Site called Ani, but I won't keep you any longer. I think we can have the time, but please come and visit us.
There is no stopping this man, Kenan. Thank you very much indeed. And we will have you back on again to talk about some of those destinations.
You're most welcome. Cheers. I look forward to talking to you again.
Istanbul Fact File. Turkish Airlines flies direct from 8 US cities and Toronto. Major cities of Europe and Tel Aviv are serviced by Turkish and Pegasus Airlines. Anadolu Jet is a subsidiary budget airline of Turkish Airlines and flies to some European and Middle Eastern destinations. Turkish mainly flies from the new Istanbul airport and Pegasus from Sapihogokin. Both are at least 45 minutes from the city centre. Both airports have bus services to various parts of the city. One can pay using the Istanbul card, credit card or cash. There are taxis just outside the arrivals of both airports. Larger parties are recommended to take vans rather than separate taxis. A more luxurious blue taxi service is also available at a slightly higher rate, together with van taxis. Five-star hotels include the Four Seasons Bosphorus, Sirigan Kempinski Palace, Four Seasons Sultan Ahmed, and the soon-to-open Shangri-La and Peninsula. And special good value, JW Marriott Karakov, The Vault Karakov, and Blue House Sultan Ahmed. The currency is the Turkish lira, and 100 Turkish lira are worth $13. Among the restaurants with Bosphorus views are Sunset, Ulus 29, 360, Bebek Balisisi, Mikla, Hamdi, and Lasivert. There are 6 kosher grocery stores, however, no restaurants for the time being.
It's time for the latest travel news. Hot on the heels of launching its new Tel Aviv-New York route, American Airlines announced it'll start a Tel Aviv-Miami route 3 times a week from June.
LL controlling shareholder Eli Rosenberg is completing the process of taking a $300 million loan for the airline. At the same time, Rosenberg will inject an additional $75 million into the company, which is streamlining.
The chief executives of major US airlines met the White House's COVID-19 response coordinator, Jeff Zients. Airlines strongly object to the possibility of requiring pre-departure COVID-19 testing before domestic flights.
Greece, Cyprus, and Israel sealed agreements allowing citizens with COVID-19 vaccination certificates to travel without restrictions between the 3 countries.
And the skies will only fully open sometime in 2023 or 24, according to Lancet magazine editor Richard Horton. He says travel and tourism will resume when 4 to 5 billion people are vaccinated. He made the comments to the Jerusalem Post's Mayan Jaffe Hoffman. There are thousands of tour guides in Israel, each with their own unique style. Sharon Wagner-Zauda writes comedy in her spare time and brings a sharp wit wherever she takes visitors. We asked Sharon about her favourite place in Israel,
But first, a little bit about herself.
I grew up in the UK. I grew up in London. I worked in various different Jewish organisations and trained as a history teacher before making Aliyah in 1997 on my own. And in 98, I started the tour guide course. And I did that for 2 years. And the idea being that I wanted to continue teaching history, but surprisingly, nobody in Israel wanted to know about British history, which is what I've been sort of trained in. And so I've been a tour guide basically since the year 2000. I live in Jerusalem. I'm married. I've got 3 kids.
What brought you to Israel from England?
I decided when I was 14 that I wanted to make Aliyah. In the kind of way that only a 14-year-old can decide something, in a kind of belligerent, annoying sort of way. I was very affected by my youth movement, and also my school used to run a trip that you came to Israel for 5 months when you were 14. And that's when the realization was for me that I could still love England and appreciate England and Britishness and all of that stuff, but actually that we live in quite a miraculous time where a state of Israel exists. And I thought, well, wouldn't that be amazing if I could be a part of that? But I kind of waited till I sort of had some qualifications or something that I could give at least, so that I wouldn't just turn up and go, hey, I'm here. And the whole country would go, I'm sorry, why? So I decided to have a teaching qualification, and I arrived when I was 25.
As a tour guide, where is your favorite place in Israel?
There's loads of places that I love doing and I love going to. But really, my favorite place is Tel Dan in the Northern Galilee. I don't know whether it's just because it looks more like England or something, because it's quite, it's got, you know, rivers and streams and beautiful trees. But actually, I thought that was it. But I just love that there are so many different elements that are all in one site. That's incredible, because first of all, you have this beautiful nature reserve with a natural spring that does 250 million cubits of water a year, sort of thing. Like, it's this massive amount of water in a country where we're very water poor. Second of all, it's got an amazing archaeological site, some of it coming from the Canaanite period, say like from Abraham and Sarah, and some of it coming from the time just after Solomon, where the kingdom split. And there's archaeological evidence that comes from there. And the third bit of archaeological stuff, which blew people away in 1995 when they published it, was the first extra biblical source of the House of David. It's like this victory stele. It's a stone. It's got engravings. Writing is what archaeologists love the best. And they were able from that to see it said Bet David. And there's an argument within the archaeological world. Is it Bet David? Is it the House of David? Could it be Bet Dod? Because there's no vowels, like my uncle's house. Could it be Bet Dud? Somebody said, oh, maybe it means the house of the kettle or the, you know, the water carrier.
The hot water tank.
And the thing is that, yeah, the water tank. So I actually was in an amazing position to actually ask an expert, Dr. Wayne Horowitz, who actually teaches archaeology at Hebrew University. And I said to him, listen, you work in this world, you know, however much there's a lot of people in Israel would love it to be Bet David. Is it just wishful thinking or is there actually something in that? And he said to me, the majority of people in the archaeological world absolutely believe this is the first outside of the Bible, extra biblical source of the Davidic dynasty. And the people who don't believe that are actually twisting it to fit their own ideas. That's what he said. And I bow to his knowledge because he is an expert in Sumerian and Akkadian and all this kind of ancient stuff that I bow to his greater knowledge. So there's the beautiful scenery, there's the archaeological evidence, and then there's the whole story connected up with the Six-Day War in 1967. Because the reason why it took them till 94, 95 to actually find this inscription was they weren't actually able to excavate on that side of the Tell, which is an ancient archaeological mound, because that was the side that was closest to the Lebanese-Syrian border. And in the run-up to the 1967 Six-Day War, there was a massive argument about who owns the sources of the River Jordan, and especially about the springs in the area leading into the Dan, which produces this huge amount of water. And so there was firing backwards and forwards. The IDF told the archaeological team, dig on the other side. And they were like, all right then. And so they dug on the other side and they found these amazing walls from the time of the first temple period, and they found all kinds of amazing archaeological stuff. But it was only later on, I mean, it's been an ongoing archaeological dig for like 30, 40, 50, I mean, it's just a huge amount of time. And it's only in 94, 95, 96, where they found it in those seasons, that they were able to deal on the other side of the tell where they found those inscriptions.
Have you ever just been up there alone, sort of one day, and thought, I'm going to go there? It's a great place to be on your own, or do you always go there with others?
So I live in Jerusalem. I don't own a car. It's not nearby. So like, it's not like... If you're on the way to the Lebanese border, then yeah, it's on the way. But the idea of just going to Tel Dan on my own, it would be kind of weird to leave my family and organize myself to go up there on my own. But a lot of times when I am there, they've also got this place where you can actually go into the water. There's a wading pool. And I do find that I actually do get some time to contemplate or to be slightly separate from the group when they have, like when we're walking between different sites there. Sometimes there is opportunity and there's something that's beautiful. It's quite meditative. The water crashing over the rocks. I've got some beautiful pictures of there that I keep in my house. This is what calm looks like to me, which I think we're kind of needing more and more at this time, actually. But no, generally I'm with a group.
For our listeners, how would they get there?
Just head north. It's in what's called the Etzba HaGalil. It's in the Finger of the Galilee. You'll be able to stay at either HaGoshrim, which is a beautiful guest house nearby, or Kfar Blum, which is another excellent place to stay very close to that area. It's also very close to a really nice and, I wouldn't say so difficult, water hike, where you literally walk through a riverbed called the Chatzbani or the Snir. And when you walk through that, because sometimes you can do, like, I always think, do the education in the morning when your brain's vaguely awake. And then you can do a nice water hike, or you can go to, there's a lovely fish restaurant called Dagaladan, which is right next to it. I don't even like fish that much, and I'll eat everything there. It's like amazing. But when you sit in that restaurant, you can actually see people walking past on the river, which is the Chatzbani Snir hike. So it's always nice to do the hike and look at everyone sitting there having their lunch, and then be the people having their lunch going, look at you having your hike. So it's kind of nice.
So it sounds like it's either a car or an organized trip with somebody like yourself.
Yes.
So if somebody does want somebody like you to guide them around Tel Dan, how can they get hold of you?
I am available on my email, which is Sharon Tova, SHARONTOVA, at gmail.com.
That's SharonTova at gmail.com. And we've been in conversation with Sharon Wagner-Zauder, tour guide extraordinaire, about Tel Dan and a little bit about your story of why you came to Israel. Thank you so much indeed for your time.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
The Tel Dan Fact File. How to get to Tel Dan. Drive along Route 99 between Kiryat Shemoneh and Masadeh, about 7 miles east of the Metsudot Junction near Kibbutz Dan. To get there by bus from Tel Aviv, travel by Route 845 to Tel Chai and Route 36 to the Dan intersection. The reserve is a 25-minute walk from that intersection. Opening hours for the reserve during the summer between Sunday and Thursday, and also on Shabbat between 8 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the evening. On Friday and holiday evenings between 8 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Hotels near Tel Dan can be found at nearby Kibbutz HaGoshrim, Kibbutz Dafna and Moshav She'ar Yashuv. And cottages and villas are also available through Airbnb and all good booking websites.
Quiz answers coming up in a minute, but I'd like to say a big thanks to Kenan Tamer and Sharon Wagner-Zauder. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star rating and very pleasant comments on your podcast provider.
And finally, it's those quiz question answers. Our first question was, which mountain lies just to the west of Tel Dan? And the answer, Mount Lebanon.
And the second question, what is the longest word in Turkish?
And a bonus point for knowing its English meaning. The answer is, bear with me on this one, Mova faki etsis leti resile sitrevere mebe. David, you have a go.
That was extremely good.
I got to about 30 letters.
I'll carry on from where you were up to with Vera mia bili cekle rimidinden mishtinsens. Do you know what?
Should we get somebody else to do this? Because you and I will be at this all evening.
Okay. I'm going to hand this over to Nita, who is a very good friend of the podcast, and she is from Istanbul. Take it away, Nita. Mark, any idea what it means?
At a rough guess, does it mean as though you are from those whom we may not be able to easily make into the maker of unsuccessful ones? I think anybody who had that, give yourself more than a bonus point.
And that is the perfect note, or very long Turkish word of 70 letters, to finish this particular podcast. Again, please send us your comments and give us 5-star reviews. And we'll see you the next time on
the Travel Edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast.